Welcome to Raw Talk on M88. Call in with your questions or comments. Toll free 1-866-730-4921. Or submit your question to Dear DJ at M88.org. Now, it's time for some Raw Talk on M88.
And welcome to Raw Talk here on M88. I'm your host, Yo. Thanks for joining me this evening. And man, am I excited about tonight's show. Why? Because we're talking about one of my favorite topics of all time. We're going to talk a little bit about apologetics for a new generation, and I'm just so stoked that we're going to be able to discuss this tonight, and we'll get into that here in just a moment. Real quick, wanted to remind you, if you do have questions from tonight's program, and you know you're too shy to call them in or whatnot, you can send those questions to Dear DJ at our website, m88.org. Just log on to the website, click on Dear DJ, and submit your questions there, and we'll get those answered this week. Or, you know, if you got something you want to say and you follow us on Twitter, you can send us a little quick Twitter post. You can follow M88 on Twitter, twitter.com/M88radio. Another way to stay up to date with everything we got going on in the upcoming months, the busy summer months. We got our DJ volleyball tournament coming up July 10th. We have our golf tournament coming up August 1st, one of the main ways that we raise funds to keep the station going. So if you like the ministry of M88 and like programs like Raw Talk, that's one way you can help them continue, is to come play golf with us. August 1st, we're going to be playing out at the Isleta Golf Course. We'll have more details on that coming soon. We announced the bands for Freedom Fest at Jubilee Fest this past Friday. Got some great bands coming up Labor Day weekend, and we'll have more details on Freedom Fest here in the next few weeks as well. So lots going on this summer. Easy way to stay up to date with all that is follow M88 on Twitter, twitter.com/M88radio, or check our website, M88.org. Well, tonight's a special treat, especially if, for those of you who were at Jubilee Fest on Friday. We got to hear from Sean and Josh McDowell. Josh McDowell, I'm not unabashed to say, one of my heroes of the faith, a guy who's written a lot of books, and a lot of his writings, a lot of his insights helped me quite a bit when I was making that transition from high school to college. And when it came to defending what I believed as a Christian, that was the time period for me when I really realized I had to know why I believed what I believed, not just what I believed. And ever since that crucial turning point in my life, I have been a huge advocate of having people discover why you believe what you believe. That's why I do a program like Raw Talk, as those of you who listen to the show know. That's the one thing we're always challenging and pushing you to do. Why do you believe what you believe? And if you can't answer that question, then what good is your belief to begin with? You might want to go back and re-examine it. Well, we're going to do some of that examination tonight with a guy who is a speaker. You heard him at Jubilee Fest. Those of you who were there, he's an author. He's a full-time teacher, interestingly enough. And he's joining us tonight, Sean McDowell. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Sean. I appreciate you being a part of the program. Are you there, Sean?
You betcha.
All righty. Now, Sean, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself, just so that they can get to know you. I'm sure a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, he's Josh's kid. But I know you have your own story beyond just that. So why don't you tell people a little bit about your story and how you came into doing some of the same things that your father did.
Well, yo, it's a treat to be with you. I actually married my high school sweetheart for 9 years, have two kids, and I did grow up in the McDowell home, but I certainly, in college, the first person asked me to speak on apologetics, and I said, first off, that's my dad's thing. I don't have anything to say, and it scares me to death to speak. So the fact that I do apologetics and I speak to youth was not something I was aiming at doing when I was younger. I just saw the need for it, and really God broke my heart and led me down that path. So right now, I actually teach high school full-time. So I'm with students every day, teaching worldviews, teaching apologetics. So it really gives me a handle on what's gone on in culture and what kids are asking. And I get a chance to speak at events like this past weekend with you there in Albuquerque. And then I do some writing as well. So I love apologetics, but my real passion is just how do we effectively reach this new generation of young people?
And that's a question that a lot of people are grappling with, and I'm excited to grapple that question with you. Real quick, what subject do you teach?
Well, I teach a few classes. I have comparative religion classes.
Cool.
I have introduction to theology. I teach a whole year on apologetics. I teach worldviews kind of through the lens of film. I teach the Old Testament. So really Bible apologetics philosophy type classes.
Very cool. And your book, Apologetics for a New Generation, wasn't one that you necessarily wrote, but it has contributions from lots of different people. Guys like David Geisler, your dad, Josh McDowell, Mark Matlock. You interview Skip Heitzig in the book, and just lots of contributions from all across the board. And I think for me, at least, that was part of what made it such a compelling reading as I was going through it, partly because I've talked to a few of these guys here on Raw Talk, so it's always fun to read their stuff after you've had a chance to talk with them. But just to hear so many different people so passionate about a subject that, let's be honest, is not a subject most Christians get excited about, sadly enough. I mean, most Christians, you hear apologetics like, oh, yeah, well, that's for the bookworms. That's for the nerdy Christians. That's for the Christians who like to study. And for me, that's just kind of sad. I don't know. I mean, how do you feel about the general apathy that some Christians have towards apologetics in general?
You know, to be honest with you, Yo, it utterly breaks my heart. And that's the reason why I wrote this book, is that I care about ministering to this generation. And you know, because we're about the same age, for the past 15 years, there's been all this talk within the Christian community about how we're in a postmodern culture and everything needs to change. And so many of those voices from leaders are saying that apologetics and defending the faith don't matter anymore. And I read all those books, I've been in discussions, and if that was true, then we shouldn't do apologetics. But what studies show, and what my experience, I think, supports as well, is that apologetics is probably one of the two or three most important components we must do for effective ministry today. And in my opening chapter in this book, I cited a Christianity Today article, a survey they did with Zondervan, and they basically said, you know, asking people in ministry what has to change. And one of the big things that they said in there is that we have to be more effective in our relational outreach, and second, we have to better equip people apologetically. So you're right that people really downplay this and poo-poo it, so to speak, and that just breaks my heart but motivates me more to do resources like this book on, to speak on it and equip the young people, because my experience is when young people get it, they come alive. When they have somebody who's going to answer their questions and give them freedom to explore truth, young people come alive, and they love that.
You know, one of the things that's been going on in the church right now is the whole emerging slash emergent movement of churches. And, you know, in all fairness, they bring up some good concerns. Like, yeah, you make valid points about some concerns about the church. I don't necessarily agree with their approach for solving them, but they seem to have this approach. Not seem, they do. I'm not a fan of emerging church, in case anyone is curious, but anyone who listens to the program knows that. You know, they're all about, oh, it's all about the experience. You know, doubt is good. We don't need to answer doubt. We need to embrace doubt. We need to let doubt just kind of exist. It's the mystery of God. And they go on and on and on and on. And to be perfectly honest, I understand. God's a big God, and we'll never be able to completely solve the mystery of God. Granted. But darned if the Bible doesn't point out a lot of solid facts that we can say absolutely, I can know this about God, and it's that solid truth that I can stand on. I don't need to have this sort of wishy-washy, I'm just experiencing the mystery, brother, that we can actually go forward with that. But it, you know, so many people are like, wow, that's profound, that's intellectual, yeah, just enjoy the mystery. That's not really going to help our world change at all if we're just going, yeah, God's a mystery, I have no answers.
You know, my experience, and one of the reasons that motivated in this book, is let me first say this. There's a big difference between the emerging and the emergent church. Emerging is a big word that basically describes people who are trying to do effective ministry today that are missionally oriented. In some sense, you and I might be described in certain circles as emerging. But emergent has taken on an idea that basically says our world is postmodern. How do we change the message and, in certain circumstances, not only the approach, but the message itself changes to this culture? Now, that concerns me. Mm-hmm. And my only real general problem with the emergent church is that I don't think we live in a solely postmodern culture. That's the starting point for the emergent church. But I actually agree with William Lane Craig, who I'm sure you're familiar with, probably one of the greatest Christian philosophers alive today. His recent book, Reasonable Faith, he starts off and he says, you know, you might be wondering why in a postmodern culture I'm offering a reasonable faith. aren't we just supposed to embrace the mystery of God, like you said, yo?
Yeah.
Aren't we supposed to just reach out to people relationally? He says, I've been speaking to hundreds of thousands of young people internationally. And he says this idea that young people don't have rational questions and that apologetics doesn't work is a myth. He said the idea that we live in a postmodern culture, understood philosophically, is a myth. Rather, you think about it. We live in a predominantly secular culture. You hear young people say, oh, that's just true for you, but not true for me. I'm sure you've heard that, yo. I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
Notice they don't say that about science. They don't say that about math. They say that about religion and morality, which means that our culture, what trumps the area of religion is scientific facts. So oddly, what's happened in the past few years is that all these Christians have been saying, oh, just embrace the mystery of God. We can't have knowledge. We can't have truth. And right through the back door march all these new atheists who are critiquing Christianity like never before with scientific, rational arguments.
Yep.
So William Lane Craig actually says in his book, and it's pretty bold, he says, I think the idea that we solely live in a postmodern culture is a myth largely perpetrated by Satan.
Well,
and that's pretty bold, isn't it? And then
yeah.
he goes, think about it, that we have been convinced by people within the church to lay down some of our most powerful weapons of reason and rationality simply to hand them over and not embrace them. So that's what motivates me. I know that's what motivates you. That's why I wrote Apologetics for a New Generation. It's because we're fighting battles within the church and without the church.
Yep.
And effective ministry today, we must be training kids in apologetics.
I thought it was so cool that in this book it was pointed out, I don't remember which person was writing the particular essay, they all blended together, but it was really good. I liked how it was pointed out, exactly what you're saying, that we live in a world that wants it both ways. They enjoy objective truth when it comes to science, medicine, and math. And in those areas, they want objective truth, absolutes, and answers. And they don't want the runaround. You know, we absolutely want to know that we evolved from apes. We absolutely want to know that the Big Bang was how the world came to be. We absolutely want to know that there's a pill for everything that ails us. We want objective truth when it comes to those areas of life. But when it comes to religion and emotions and all that type of stuff, then it's all subjective. What works for you, man. Doesn't work for me. And I thought it was so interesting that that was pointed out, because to be honest, it was one of those things I knew innately, but I hadn't really articulated. It's like, oh, it's true. Because I know there's a hunger in our culture for answers, and yet we're being attacked with this whole thing. Oh, people don't really want answers because you can't really answer anything. It's postmodern. There are no such thing as answers. So the question is, how do we engage a culture where they want it both ways? They want objective truth, but they want religion to be subjective. How do we reconcile those two when we're talking to people in this culture?
Well, I think the point you're making is completely true. That's why Oprah Winfrey can get on her show and be an expert about religion. She can talk as if she's an authoritative voice on religion, but notice, she doesn't get up there and talk about car mechanics. She doesn't get up there and talk about dentistry. She doesn't get up there and talk with authority on history. But when it comes to religion, because it's all considered a matter of private faith, anybody can get on there and be an expert. So I think partly what we have to do is in our discussions, and this is why the very second chapter in the book by Brett Kunkel called Truth Never Gets Old is to challenge that perception of truth. In conversations, in how we write, in the movies that we make, people need to realize that Christianity by its nature is not the type of thing that can be true for you and false for me. It's not making subjective claims about my life. Jesus made universal, objective claims about creation, about human nature, and about our ultimate destiny. And I found with people a lot of times they have this presumption, like you said, that they kind of want truth in science realm but not in religion. And we're able to bridge that gap a little bit and say, do you realize religion makes subjective claims? Then we've at least opened up the door to have sophisticated conversations and to talk about what Christianity really means.
It seems to me this is the area where, for Christianity, the rubber meets the road. Because if we are going to demonstrate that the Bible has objective truth that applies to every aspect of our lives, then we're in a better position to actually discuss that with other people. But when they see that we don't really apply the Bible to every aspect of our lives, but we treat the Bible subjectively. Well, it, you know, gives me good principles for this area of my life, but in this area of my life, I'm on my own. I just got to do the best I can. When we have a selective attitude, which, let's be honest, so many of us do. I've fallen into that myself on occasion. Well, then, of course, the world's not going to listen to us when we say, no, the Bible is objective truth. When people look at us and say, no, you apply it subjectively. How could that be true for me as well when you don't even apply it to every aspect of your life? It seems like an area that we really need to work on if we're going to engage people in, you know, in an intelligent conversation about this, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say that. In fact, one of the interesting things in working on this book that I realized, and it seems so obvious now, but I didn't see it going into it, is how differently younger people see truth than the older generation does. For example, take maybe 35 or 40 and up. If somebody was a hypocrite in that generation, they would look at their hypocrisy and say, that person is not living according to what he says is true. Do you know how young people tend to look at hypocrites and people that are kind of making their faith compartmentalized like you talk about? Rather than saying that person is inconsistent with their beliefs, they simply say those person's beliefs are false. So in many ways, that's why hypocrisy, rather than people looking at it and go, oh, those people are hypocrites, they're not living according to Christian truth, they look at it and they say Christianity is false. So there's this profound confusion about the nature of truth and et cetera. But what that does is that shows that for us, the way we live, the choices that we make, how we treat people, that we actually have a biblical worldview in all areas of our lives, and being authentic is one of the most powerful apologetics today. So it has to be any apologetic. What we're trying to do in this book is bring balance. Because sometimes people have erred, and I think the emergent church errs on just overemphasizing relationships. Well, fundamentalists in the past have overemphasized doctrine. Well, truth, the best approach is always truth in the context of relationships. And I think we've met that unique balance in Apologetics for New Generation.
Well, we're talking with Sean McDowell, the general editor of Apologetics for a New Generation. And maybe you can help me with a frustration that I have, Sean. I recently went through the Truth Project, you know, put out by Focus on the Family, and had a great time going through that. It just got me thinking about all kinds of things and kind of re-fanned my flame for my passion for apologetics. And you know what? Christians need to be smart. They need to be intelligent. They need to be articulate in how they talk about their faith and why they believe what they believe. But one of the things I encountered while I was doing that was so many of the people who attend the class, they were excited when it started. But once they realized that it was going to take work to understand it, they would say things like, well, I'm not intellectual, so I can't really do this. So I'm not going to be coming anymore. Or, I couldn't really follow that, so I don't know. You know, I got so upset with how people were intellectually lazy. You know, the fact that the Truth Project didn't dish out things in nice little bite-sized, three-point, easy-to-consume pieces of information, but that people would actually have to sit there, pay attention, think it through, take some notes, maybe go back and review their notes to really understand what's being said, instead of being willing to do the work. They just wanted to walk away. How do we get Christians excited about being articulate, intelligent defenders of the truth, as opposed to being just sort of apathetic attenders on Sunday, just tell me something that makes me feel good so I can go home and be happy the rest of the week until I come back next Sunday? I mean, how do we get people to engage in apologetics?
You know, in Apologetics for New Generation, I interviewed J.P. Moreland, who you know is a Ph.D. and an apologist and one of the leading philosophers in the world. And I asked him, I said, why do you think a lot of people kind of downplay and criticize apologetics? And he said something that really stuck with me. He said, you know what? He said, we live in a culture in which people are largely lazy inside the church and outside the church. I mean, think about with the Internet, with fast food. I mean, we have a whole generation of people, a culture that really does not just value critical deep thinking in the life of the mind. So a lot of, I think, people, whether it's in the emergent church or in whatever, will downplay apologetics because it takes thoughtfulness. It takes depth. So within the church, we're fighting a battle not only doing apologetics on the outside, but trying to motivate people on the inside to see why it matters. Now, I would say a couple things that will make a difference. One is we need pastors from the pulpit preaching it regularly how important it is and incorporating it into their talks. It needs to start from the top down, that every pastor is trained to some degree in apologetics, works it into their message, emphasizes it, talking about it, shows the value of it. I mean, Lee Strobel talks a lot about, when I interviewed and hear him too, he said we need to have pastors from the top down showing practical stories about how apologetics make a difference in their life. Second is Nancy Piercy has a book called Total Truth, and you've probably read it or seen it, and there she talks about this profound sense of joy that comes when we really start to have a holistic worldview. And I think you and I are already motivated to understand and read, so we skip the step of showing people the value of what they're doing and really investing and getting them to buy into that picture. So I think we need to expend a lot of energy just showing how valuable to evangelism, to discipleship, to our relationship with God, and even spiritual formation, the life of the mind plays in that role. And I think when we show it, a lot more people will buy into things like the Truth Project and apologetics that you and I are trying to do.
Now, how important is it to do this in mid-school groups and high school groups? Because one of my pet peeves, and everyone who listens to Raw Talk knows that this is how I feel, that those often turn into Christian bubbles of safety. Send your kid here and keep them out of trouble. We'll teach them not to drink, not to have premarital sex, not to do drugs. And then when they get to college and someone confronts them with the quote-unquote truth of science and how the Bible is just a bunch of myths that primitive man came up with to help them cope with things that they didn't understand, but now we know better. And then these high schoolers who had a very safe time in youth group all through high school and mid school, they get to college, suddenly they don't know what to think anymore. I remember one time I was at a college retreat and I didn't handle it very well. I wasn't a very patient college student. This guy went to his biology class and he was sitting in our bunk area, and he's saying, "Man, you know, they're talking about all this stuff in my biology class, and I just don't know where it fits with the Bible, and I just don't know what to believe anymore. I don't know if I can be a Christian anymore." I didn't respond very compassionately. I think God has tempered my patience when it comes to this, but I basically said, "What are you, a moron? You are you serious? You're worried because your professor said that you came from a monkey, and now you don't know if you can believe the Bible? Seriously? Have you read your Bible?" I mean, I kind of went off on the poor guy. I don't know if I helped him or not, but I was just so shocked that someone was willing to give up so easily, that one little confrontation in college, next thing, I don't know what to believe anymore. And that was the point when I started thinking, of course, then again, what am I learning? What did I learn in youth group? I learned to memorize a few verses every now and then, learned some good Bible stories, learned all the do's and don'ts of how to behave as a Christian. But I'd never really learned about the historic and scientific evidences for the truth of the Bible. That wasn't a big focus. How do you feel about this? How much do you think that youth groups, along with all that other stuff, it's good, should focus on teaching kids to defend what they believe, teach them why they believe what they believe?
Your experience, Yo, with this young person is not abnormal at all. I was up at UC Berkeley, which you know is one of the most liberal, if not the most liberal, school in the country, and it's one of the top public schools. And I was talking with the head of the largest ministry. I have about 600 students coming on Friday nights, many of them non-Christians. It's the largest outreach there. And I said, "Do you lose a lot of Christians who come on campus? Do they walk away from their faith?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what? Why does it happen?" And he looked at me and said, "You know what happens?" He said, "We have students who walk on campus." He goes, "And the first time a professor says, 'Oh, you know, the Bible is just a bunch of myths or fables,' or the first time the professor says, 'We know the world evolved and God was not involved,' he says it rocks these kids. And many of them never recover from that." Mm-hmm. Now, my question, my passion is, how do I get to those kids before that happens,
right,
so they can avoid being shocked and walking away from their faith? Well, something I did recently, and we could talk about this a whole nother show sometime, is I actually take my students up to UC Berkeley, juniors and seniors, and we invite in local atheist leaders. We invite in a homosexual activist, a Unitarian Universalist pastor one time, and we allow them to speak to our students. Now, I'm sitting in the back monitoring this whole thing, but I've taught my students for months how to ask good questions, how to recognize faulty thinking, how to just engage somebody in discussion and defend their faith, and then afterwards we go debrief for an hour. We also give our kids surveys and send them out on campus to get in discussion with non-believers. And let me tell you something. These kids come alive. They love it. In fact, two students were so motivated that they came back and they said, Mr. McDowell, we'd like to go to our youth group and do a Thursday night, like, 6 to 10 week apologetic series. So they had me come in one night on a Wednesday night and do the thing where I do a little play the atheist, where I give the arguments of atheists and really motivate Christian kids to realize, holy cow, I don't know why I believe in the Bible. I don't know what I think about evolution. I don't know how to answer the problem of evil. And then I was setting them up so she would come in the next few weeks and answer it. Well, this youth group has about 40 or 50 kids. 30 of them have been coming out on Thursday nights. And she's been talking about intelligent design. She's been teaching on the problem of evil. And these kids are loving it. Hmm. So when I hear that apologetics doesn't matter to young people or it's not important, my first thought is does whoever's saying that actually even work with students? I actually think that youth ministers who do not do at least some training in apologetics are being unfaithful to their calling to be a youth pastor. And that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, it is.
But I think they are being unfaithful. And it's just as important as talking about sexual purity, which every youth leader does, just as important as talking about all the other issues. If they don't do it, they're putting our kids at a disadvantage and more likely to have their faith rocked when they get into college.
Now, I know some people are listening to you talk about doing those surveys and having those people come and talk to your students and asking questions. And I already know some people are saying, but what if they ask a question I don't know the answer to? What do I do then? What do you do when you're faced with a situation where someone asks you a question about Christianity and you don't have the answer? Obviously, the answer is not to abandon Christianity, so what's the other alternatives?
Well, when I talk about doing these trips, I'm not recommending that any youth pastor call up a local atheist and say, hey, come in and speak to my students. Look, I do this for a living. I've written multiple books on apologetics. I have 2 master's degrees. I'm starting a PhD next spring. So this is my area of expertise. You know, other areas of expertise I would not be as great in, whether it's politically or something else. So I do this type of trip because I'm comfortable with my knowledge and I've been in these situations before. I wouldn't recommend a youth pastor going into anything specifically like that without some serious scholars and people around them that can guide them, because you could actually do a lot of harm to kids.
Yeah.
But the survey thing is everybody should do it. I just talked to a youth pastor this weekend, in fact, at Calvary Albuquerque.
Cool.
That's what Pastor Nate does. He takes some of the students out, and he gives them kind of surveys, or they get in conversations. And then they come back, and they debrief, and the student goes, wait a minute, this guy asked about Buddhism. Oh, wait a minute, this guy said, you know, problem of evil, and you have this natural interest and a chance to teach kids truth. So, in fact, for your listeners, I've actually, on my website, I've put 2 survey forms that we've come up with for free. And we've had a lot of youth groups, and even parents, like homeschool parents, take their kids to a college campus and just get in conversation. So if you go to SeanMcDowell.org, and there's a little bar that says teaching youth, if you get on there, they're just free. It says Survey 1 and 2, and it's a real easy way to get kids thinking and train them in their faith.
That's a great idea. Maybe we should do that as a radio station with some of our listeners sometime. Sounds like it'd be a lot of fun. But, man, that's cool. And now, the other thing I wanted to address before we move on to some of the interesting, more specific topics that are addressed in the book was it's not just the realm of youth groups and pastors that need to instill in kids the importance of apologetics. After I went through the Truth Project, I realized I need to start talking with my girls now about why the Bible is true. And granted, my girls are 4 and 7, but I've learned very rapidly with my kids that you never assume that a kid won't get something. They're always smarter than you believe. And if you challenge them to come up to your level, more often than not, they'll do just that as opposed to trying to always talk down to them. And so, especially with my 7-year-old and a little bit with my 4-year-old, I've been doing very light apologetic stuff. You know, when they talk about, Jesus is God, and you say, well, why do you know Jesus is God? And, you know, kids ask why questions. I think parents should ask their kids why questions to make their kids think about it. How important is it in the parental realm, Sean, and what are some things that parents can do to instill a love and an excitement about knowing why they believe what they believe when they're kids, when they're really young?
Yo, can I just say thank you for emphasizing that it's not just pastors and Bible teachers that are supposed to do apologetics?
Sure, no problem.
Seriously. Yeah. Thank you, because there's this mentality that says, well, that's my pastor, he went to seminary. Well, that's my Bible teacher, he did it, as if it's a professional thing.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you pointed that out. I'm glad I pointed it out, because I don't want anyone to think I'm down on pastors. If anyone's responsible for this, it has to start in the home, doesn't it?
Yes. All studies show, everyone, that the prime influence on a young person is the family, period. It's not the media. It's not the educational system. It's not our secular culture, as influential as those are. It's primarily the parents. That's why the Bible, it just, like when you read the Psalms, you read Proverbs, when Solomon is talking to his son, he just assumes, he never says to talk to your kids in this context, because he assumes that's exactly what parents are doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the assumption. It's our job to do it. And there's actually an article in this, I'm sure you read, by Chris Sherrod, and it's called Home Field Advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a good chapter for parents, specifically their kids, that the Christian Research Journal just called him and said, hey, will you kind of adapt your article a little bit and put it in our journal, because no one has worded it quite that way. So a couple things he talks about. Number one is he just talks about the importance of just being able to create an environment in your family in which questions can even be asked.
Hmm.
So it's amazing in the Christian church. If somebody says, boy, I'm struggling with anger, I'm struggling with lust, I'm struggling with this, everybody's okay with it. But when somebody says, I'm having doubts about the Bible or doubts about God, it's like we freak out.
Yeah, everyone flees, like, oh, well, I can't be around you anymore.
Exactly. But he says it's in the home. And he, you know, and even in my interview, Lee Strobel mentioned this as well. He says, create a culture in your family. Just say to your kids, you know, you can ask Daddy everything. You can ask Mommy anything about the world. And if I don't know it, I'll find an answer for you. And just creating that environment will make a huge difference ministering to a kid. Another practical one that Chris talks about, he says, just using examples in pop culture, like using movies. And every parent has to decide what kids can and can't see at age-appropriate times. But when I was in high school, my dad took me to see Schindler's List.
Yeah.
And I never forget afterwards, he asked me, point blank, he said, son, do you think the killing of 6 million Jews was wrong? I said, of course. And he said, well, why? I said, well, the Bible says you shouldn't kill people. He said, why does the Bible say this? And I said, well, I don't know. And he pointed me that it's the Bible. Killing's not wrong because it says it in the Bible. The Bible says it because it's wrong. And ultimately, right and wrong stem from the character of God, who is truth and who is life. So he used a practical example, such as a movie, to just get me thinking about worldview issues. So there's a lot of practical things that parents can do, and especially in our culture, in which kids are getting so much information and so many ideas through the Internet, if we don't do it, boy, our kids are going to believe some wild stuff, and a good chance they'll walk away from the faith that you and I cherish so much.
Yeah, I can hear your kids in the background right now amening all of that. Well, we're talking with Sean McDowell, the general editor, and he's also an author, but he put together this book, Apologetics for a New Generation. And a couple of things that jumped out at me while I was going through this book that I wanted to touch on before we ran out of time, some really interesting specifics on how apologetics can apply to certain areas. One of the ones that really stuck with me was the concept of beauty. And how beauty is not subjective. And that's something that most people just presume. Oh, everyone knows that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. But that hasn't always been the case. And I love the chapter where it's talking about the two areas that the church, for whatever reason, has given up is reason and beauty. We've given up the arts and we've given up science and the rest. And said, well, that's the realm of the world and we're more concerned with relationship with God, which is important. But we've handed over those other areas. Whereas traditionally in the past, both of those areas have been very much a part of Christianity, and it's only a recent phenomenon that beauty has become subjective. Before that, beauty was always an objective truth, and I'm sure some people are confused about this right now. So if you can, explain a little bit how that was described in the book, how, you know, something as simple as beauty is something that we can apply apologetics to and point people to. No, there's deeper truth to that, and beauty isn't just something that's in the eye of the beholder.
Well, when I talk to my students about subjective and objective truth, they all understand that science makes objective truth. They realize that math makes objective truth. But as soon as I put statements up about morals, about half the kids disagree. But when I put statements up about beauty, almost all Christian kids will fight it and say beauty is utterly subjective.
Hmm.
We have completely bought the idea in our culture that beauty is within the eye of the beholder. And I want to thank John Mark Reynolds, who's just a master at this. He's one of the top Plato experts in the world, and he's the head of the Torrey Academy, which is at Biola University. He has a chapter in here, and he says, to build Christianity in the next generation, we need to be committed to reason and logic, but also be committed to beauty. That beauty itself is objective. And he says, for example, everybody knows that a pile of dung is ugly. He says, and everybody just intuitively knows that a rose is beautiful. But then he points out, he says, if this is a Darwinian world, and everything is here by accident, and we're these creatures that have just come here with no purpose at all, then beauty is really just this accidental feature or byproduct of a purposeless world. He said, beauty only makes sense if there is a God and a creator to the world. So really what he's saying is things that are beautiful in the world only can be beautiful if God really exists. So when you look at worlds like I've been to Russia 13 times, and Russia is one of the most modern-day atheistic cultures. It was up until, you know, now it's not as much. But
right.
With Marxism, what happened is the culture just physically became ugly buildings, ugly cars. The museums, the beautiful churches were torn down because with a lack of God, there's no foundation for beauty. Yet one of the things that will draw people ultimately to the Christian faith is rebuilding up beauty and showing people that it really stems from the character of God. So this is a concept you can't just get in a five-minute interview back and forth on the radio, because to some people it's so foreign.
Yeah.
But if you take time to think about it a little bit and you process it, that beauty only makes sense in a world in which it's created by God and God exists. So atheists can talk about beauty, but that's only if we're actually in a theistic universe.
And one of the things that really stuck for me from that whole discussion was how previous generations of Christians have left beautiful monuments and testaments to glorify God. The beautiful cathedrals, the beautiful stained glass windows, the beautiful artwork and symphonies that have been done by believers who only wanted to do it for the glory of God. These are lasting testimonies in places like Great Britain, which is not really a Christian nation all that much anymore, despite a history of sending out lots of missionaries. And the question was put, you know, well, what is this generation leaving behind? And the sad answer was not a whole lot, because we've surrendered beauty to the culture. We let the culture make the beautiful movies, the beautiful music, the beautiful. And we do our best, but everyone knows that Christian stuff is always not quite as good. It's usually pretty cheesy. It's not as nice. And how sad is that, that we have lost that? And, man, that really got me thinking about, man, what is this generation going to leave behind as a lasting testimony to the glory of God, something beautiful? And we don't really have a lot to contribute right now, do we?
Well, it's heartbreaking to realize that. And here's why beauty matters so much. Because the new atheists in the past few years, yes, they've been attacking the scientific basis of Christianity. Yes, they've been attacking the reliability of Jesus and the Scriptures. But think about Christopher Hitchens' book, Religion Poisons Everything. In other words, the critique of Christianity is not just that Christianity is false, but that it's bad and that it's ugly for culture. And you know what? We can't let them get away with that. Not only do we have to say that Christianity is true, not only that Christianity is good, but that Christianity has led to beauty. I mean, you think about the greatest pieces of art in world history, almost predominantly created by theists or by Christians. You look at the greatest works of music, And the greatest works of art, in fact, stem from the fact that God is a creator and has made us in his image and has told us to create things like God created. So this defense of beauty and helping people to realize that part of defending the Christian faith is, yes, doing logical apologetics, but it's also contributing to the world acts of beauty, music, art, etc., is defending the goodness of Christianity and the goodness of creation.
That just gives me goosebumps thinking about that, because it's one area where I hadn't really thought of, to be perfectly honest. And then as I was reading the book, I'm thinking, man, that makes so much sense. That's so awesome. We need to do that. Come on, man. I know we can. We're talking with Sean McDowell, author and general editor of book Apologetics for a New Generation. And one of the last chapters in the book really caught my attention, because it's something, for whatever reason, and I know this sounds odd, but it's something that maybe it's because I have two daughters, I guess, but I've really latched on to the importance of women understanding what the Bible has to say about being godly women and what true femininity is. And, you know, I've talked with Leslie Ludi a couple times on the program. She's great for this. And you have, in the very end of this book, you go through how apologetics applies to all these social issues like homosexuality and race and all this type of stuff. But then there's this whole thing defending femininity. And man, I just thought that was the one. It was my favorite chapter from the book. I'll be honest. I went through that and it was so right on. And it's another one of those areas where people might be thinking, what does apologetics have to do with femininity? And I know it's not necessarily your forte, but can you, explain a little bit about what, is it Jonalyn Fincher had to say? I wasn't sure how to pronounce her first name.
Jonalyn Fincher. I'll tell you, when you do a book project like this and you're a general editor and you ask people to contribute on areas like truth or evangelism or areas of, you know, culture, is there certain things that I expect from the people I ask to contribute. This chapter absolutely blew me away.
It blew me away, too.
And to be honest, as an editor, I think about the issue of femininity. I think about how our culture and our church in particular is viewed by certain women. And it completely changed my approach to feminism. And here's one point I think she makes that's really powerful in there. She says, for example, one of the reasons that a lot of women in particular have been kept away from the church is that the church is viewed as anti-women and patriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. You walk into a church today, and there's a male pastor, there's male worship, there's male deacons, there's male pretty much everything. Now, I'm not getting in the debate about whether complementarian, egalitarian, that's not my point.
Right.
Wherever we land on that, we can put women in appropriate roles and highlight what it means to be female. And she says, for example, what draws a lot of women to Wicca is that they feel like it's empowering.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel like the church is patriarchal and it's anti-women. And a lot of us in the church don't realize this. So she starts off the chapter and asks the question that I had never even thought about before. She says, if you had a daughter or your wife, and she was going to spend time with one of the greatest religious figures in history, she said, who would you want her to spend time with? And she goes down, she goes like Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I doubt anybody would want their daughter to spend time with Muhammad, who is a polygamist and who used different wives for power for different reasons. Joseph Smith was also a polygamist and actually talked one guy out of divorcing his wife, so because he said he got a message from God to marry her. Charles Taze Russell, who started Jehovah's Witnesses, he goes down to Gautama Buddha, who abandoned his family. He says all these religious leaders have a terrible history about how they treat women except for Jesus. Jesus had women followers and every opportunity to take advantage of women, and there's not a hint that he ever did. He treated them with respect and dignity and valued what they brought to the table. That message has gotten lost in our culture today. And that's a message people need to hear, that Jesus is truly good for women. But you also look in the church, I think maybe one of the things that you highlighted about this is we have certain assumptions about things that women should do and things that men should do. And Jonalyn tells a story about how she thought she was supposed to go to knitting clubs, and she thought that she was supposed to do certain things, but she'd hear about the men going on these four-wheeling camping trips and was always envious. Well, why do we accept these certain ideas about what men are supposed to do and only women are supposed to do without really thinking about where those come from? So she's just writing to challenge that a little bit. And not, she doesn't have this feminist agenda by any, I hope our readers don't think she's trying to argue for feminism.
No, and she doesn't either.
You know? I mean, she comes with a broken heart and just says, let's just think about the words we use. Let's just think about our services. Let's just think about our activities and see if we're stereotyping and not really allowing women to be all that God has created them to be.
One other thing that has been bugging me recently, and I think applies with everything else that's discussed in the book, but it's kind of like a recent phenomenon, this idea of guys not really wanting to be men insofar as they wear, you know, girl jeans and other girl clothes, and for whatever reason that's become a trendy fashion style. But the more I've thought about it recently, the more I realize this is one area where objective truth and apologetics probably needs to start addressing when men are losing their identity as what it means to be men and trying to be, well, quite frankly, more feminine, because that's more politically correct, more acceptable to our culture, that men don't have quite as the rough edges and aren't as rough and tumble, but are, you know, a little more articulate and well put out and quite frankly more feminine. And the more this is emerging right now, and I know it's a recent trend, the more I think maybe someone needs to start writing and addressing this, because if godly men are losing their identity of what it means to be masculine in the kingdom of God, I kind of shudder for the future of this upcoming generation when men don't really know what it means to be a man anymore, and quite frankly, are trying to be something they weren't called to. How do you feel about the girl pants trend that's going on, Sean?
I think it's pretty sad to look at our culture as a whole. I mean, look at most sitcoms, whether it's Everybody Loves Raymond or The King of Queens or all of them. The men are kind of idiots. They don't get it. They're morons. I mean, they're kind of lovable, but there's no sense of this virtue and this manhood. It's the woman who's actually the responsible one.
Right.
And that confuses young people. I mean, there's more confusion among young people about sexuality, about where the distinctions are blurred there, about maleness, about femaleness. So you think about, without those solidified ideas, what fatherhood's going to look like in a generation later. And I would say this, Yo, and you maybe heard my dad say this in the press conference this past weekend. I agree with him that the greatest societal evil today, not torture, it's not solely immorality, it's fatherlessness, abandoned and disconnected dads. Almost every social ill that we see traces back to a lack of an involved father in the life of his kids. So you look at this trend among that you're talking about, I almost guarantee you the kids that we see it from are those who don't have a solid, loving relationship with a father. So that's why apologetics, and there's one of the things we talk about in this book, is that there has to be apologetics in truth, but it's always taught in the context of a relationship, and it always involves modeling. So more than ever, I am totally on board with what you said. Maybe I'll do apologetics for Generation 2, where I talk about exactly maleness and femaleness and explore these in more issues, because there's a need for that.
It's a growing need. It's for me, at least, it's growing alarmingly how this has become something that is really confused for a lot of people, and yeah, it's a big need. Well, Sean, sorry. we're almost out of time. Your dad's really cool too. I'd love to have him on the program sometime. We're just about out of time. We're talking with Sean McDowell, Apologetics for a New Generation. And Sean, why don't you tell people where they can go and find more info? Like, you know, you mentioned those surveys, but if they want to find out more about what you do, the books you've written, and all that stuff about you, where can they go and get more info about you, Sean?
Hey, thanks a lot. Can I just say, Yo, as a last word of encouragement?
Sure.
The idea of apologetics and reaching this generation can be daunting and can feel like somebody else's job, but the challenges that young people are facing today, we have to have an all-hands-on-deck response. All of us can do, even if it's in a small way with our kids, with somebody at our church, investing in the life of the next generation. It's hard for me to think about something that's more important than that.
I agree,
so
wholeheartedly.
The surveys you talked about, I've got articles, resources in the book Apologetics for New Generation. They can actually just get at my website, which is seanmcdowell.org. And Sean is S-E-A-N SeanMcDowell.org, and, you know, people can get a hold of me through there. I also have a Facebook, so I'm always looking for Facebook friends. But the way to get the resource, the book, and by the way, in the back of the book, there's a whole appendix that says what are the best resources available specifically for parents, for youth pastors, for people that want to reach this generation, what are further resources? So in many ways, that's worth the whole price of the book, because there's some great resources out there. Sometimes it gets lost. I really narrowed it down and wanted to help people out.
Well, Sean McDowell joining us here on Raw Talk, talking about apologetics for a new generation. And Sean, you're awesome. It was such a pleasure to meet you this past Friday and then to have you on the program. Thank you for sharing your time. And I know it's precious with how busy you are. I really appreciate you making some time to chat with us tonight, because I'm sure it helped and blessed a lot of people.
Hey, yo. Thank you for having me. When I first met you, I thought, boy, this is going to be a long interview, but this turned out well. I'm just kidding with you. You're a great interviewer. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, there goes my self-confidence. I'll go home and tell my wife, Sean McDowell thought it was going to be a long interview because I don't know why. Maybe I'm just kidding. Thanks, Sean. Appreciate the encouragement, man.
Hey, thank you.
Talking with Sean McDowell, and I just want to leave you guys with one last verse, one that I think is so crucial. Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world, rather than on Christ. And I hope you take that verse to heart, because this world is full of hollow and deceptive philosophies, and they will take you captive. Make no mistake about that. We are to be free in Christ. The truth will set you free. But if you aren't sure what the truth is, then you will not be experiencing freedom, and you will be held captive by hollow and deceptive philosophies. Don't let that happen to you. Be encouraged by what we discussed tonight. Take the time to discover why you believe what you believe. Take the time to think about, do you really believe that what you believe is really real? Because if it's real to you, you, my friend, will be someone who will transform and change this culture around us. And we need people who are going to turn this world upside down. You can be one of them. Thank you so much for joining us for Raw Talk tonight. I hope you were encouraged by tonight's program. And hope you have a shway week in the Lord.
Thanks for joining us on Raw Talk on M88. Get the podcast of tonight's show free at M88.org. And join us again next week for more Raw Talk on M88.